This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Four decades ago, Richard Nixon became the first United States president to resign from office. His departure from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue marked a pivotal moment not only in politics, but in American society as a whole. North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin chaired what would be known as the Senate Watergate Committee.
We are beginning these hearings today in an atmosphere of utmost gravity. The questions that have been raised in the wake of the June 17 break-in strike at the very undergirding of our democracy. If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States. And if these allegations proved to be true, what they were seeking to steal was not the jewels, money, or other property of American citizens, but something much more valuable, their most precious heritage, the right to vote in a free election.
Now, for many historians, the Watergate scandal marked the beginning of the end of Nixon's tenure. Of course, today we look back on the event that led to Nixon's downfall with some of the men who played key roles in the Watergate hearings. John Dean is with us now. He served as legal counsel to President Nixon. His latest book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
And also with us right now is Ken Rudin, our political junkie. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Frank.
Let me talk with you, John Dean, and ask you the question. Obviously, over the last 40-plus years, a lot has been said and a lot has been written. Tell us about the approach you took with your latest book.
Well, it's a book I'm not sure I would have done had I really known what I was getting into. The book started with an effort to really try to figure out why somebody as savvy and intelligent as Richard Nixon could screw up his presidency as badly as he did. And I thought most of the tapes that were already available would give me the thread and probably a few more that hadn't been examined, and I'd have the answer. Well, make a long story short, I found one. Nobody had ever cataloged all of the Nixon recorded Watergate conversations, and there were about 1,000 of them. I found about 600 of them that nobody, I think, outside the National Archives ever listened to. And then those that had been listened to, the transcripts, were really not of the best quality. The Watergate prosecutors, other than the ones they used in the trial, they were really just first drafts that had been done by FBI secretaries, and often they didn't even know who was talking. Stanley Cutler, a historian, did a really good job what he did, but he only did partial transcripts of what he thought might be interesting. So I literally tracked it day by day by day, and a rather different story emerges. We all know the general outlines of what happened, but Nixon's behavior was much different than I had known. I didn't have that much dealing with him until the very end. And it's revelatory to see actually what he did.
In what way? What did you learn?
Well, I learned, for example, he didn't get any information on Watergate from anybody other than Bob Haldeman, basically, for the first 8 months. To a degree, Bob Haldeman being his White House chief of staff, to a degree from John Ehrlichman, who had been White House counsel, but not so much. And his principal source was really Haldeman and the Washington Post for the first 8 months. And the other thing is, when he asks Haldeman and Ehrlichman questions, they dissemble. They don't tell him the truth. So he doesn't even have the basis to make some decisions early on when those decisions might need to have been made.
Interestingly enough, though, by March 21st of 1973, I'm about to play one of those tapes now that was recorded in the White House, a conversation between you and Richard Nixon. By then, he certainly did know, and he seemed to be thoroughly involved. And so, you know, the picture you raise of a president who didn't know in the early stages what was going on, by this time, he knows well what's happening. He understands that bribes are being paid. Let's listen to this clip. This is a tape recorded in the White House and a conversation between you and Richard Nixon. Let's listen.
Well, first of all, there's the problem of the continued blackmail, which will not only go on now, it'll go on when these people are in prison. And it will compound the obstruction of justice situation. It'll cost money. It's dangerous. Nobody, I think people around here are not pros. It's something, this sort of thing mafia people can do. Washing money, getting clean money, and things like that. We just don't know about those things. We're not criminals. We're not used to dealing in that business. It's a tough thing to know how to do. That's right. It's a real problem as to whether we can even do it. Plus, there's a real problem in raising money. Mitchell has been working on raising some money, feeling he's got, you know, he's one of the ones the most to lose. But there's no denying the fact that the White House and Ehrlichman, Hallam, and Dean are involved in some of the early money decisions.
How much money?
I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next few years.
So he may not have known early on, but at some point, how go ahead, John Dean.
Frank, I was going to say, what's interesting about that conversation, he builds his final defense on that conversation, that he didn't know anything until I had come in and told him that there was a cover-up, that all this money was being paid and all these problems. That, of course, was not true. Nobody had ever really looked at all the tapes before then, other than a few they found early on, the so-called smoking gun tape. But I find he has knowledge. He's very passive about it, but he's also approving everything from the payment of money to subornation of perjury by Jeb Magruder, the deputy director of the campaign. He's just enough involved that he's deeply in a part of a criminal conspiracy. But in that conversation, I don't know what he knows and what he doesn't know. I'm trying to warn him. That started when I got his attention by telling him there's a cancer on his on the presidency, and if he doesn't take care of it, it's going to end it. So this was what I was trying to brace him. And when I, for example, mentioned the $1 million in that conversation, I thought I'd picked out a thin air, a number that would stagger him. Well, I can tell you today now, after having listened to all these conversations, what he does after that conversation is he calls Rose Woods in, his secretary, and he asks her, how much money do we have in our slush fund that only you and I know about? And she tells him about $400,000. So the other thing I didn't know is he had earlier tried to raise money by selling an ambassadorship to a fellow by the name of Pappas, who had been ambassador to Greece and had somebody he wanted to stay in the job. And so Nixon calls him in, and they do a deal, and they literally sell an ambassadorship to raise money. These were the kinds of details I've been able to fill in this later effort.
John, I'm one of those people that anyone who was around in 1973 were just glued and affixed to the Watergate hearings. I'm always fascinated about what your role is. I mean, you are the guy who basically helped uncover the Nixon misdeeds and all the things that went on in the White House. But if you were a historian looking back, not John Dean looking back, but a historian, are you a good guy or a bad guy? Are you a hero or a non-hero? I'm always fascinated by what your role, how you see your role.
One of the reasons I didn't want to do the book I ended up doing, and I thought somebody else should do it, because I think the tapes tell the tale, and they pretty clearly spell out who did what and why and when. And I think I've tried not to add commentary on that along the way, and rather let the reader draw their own conclusion, because it becomes pretty evident just from the record. I'll let you draw your own conclusion when you read the book. And, there are a lot of people that fault me for, one, not coming forward earlier. Curiously enough, Nixon himself deals with that. He says, well, he had no access to me. He couldn't get to me. There was no way he could have come in earlier. And there are others who fault me for then breaking attorney-client privilege. Well, there is no attorney-client privilege for criminal activities. Plus, it was waived before I testified before the Senate Watergate Committee, and later in the trial of U.S. versus Mitchell. So one of the reasons I thought it important to write this was not for my own sake, where I do actually come out pretty well in the book. I was flabbergasted to hear Nixon's take on me before I become his number one enemy. I'm his, I'm one of his most promising staff people, and he talks about it at some length. So he was apparently very comfortable with me. I was very uncomfortable with him. I thought I really met him the first time was on that March 21st conversation when, it's an hour and 40-minute conversation. Haldeman is called in for the last 40 minutes. In that first hour, I tell him one crime after another or one problem after another, and I'm just waiting for the fist to come down on the table and say, John, we've got to end this. Well, that never happens.
But you were, after all, you served a prison sentence, prison time. time for your role. You were complicit in this, and for a while you were...
Technically, I never went to prison. I was in the witness protection program starting with the Senate Watergate hearings for almost a year and a half. I had two marshals that were with me 24-7, a whole team. I think there were six of them. Our properties were under surveillance for protective reasons. And the only time I was even close to incarcerated was when, before the trial and during the trial, the prosecutors wanted me as close to Washington as they could get me. So they had me at Fort Holabird in Maryland.
Well, let me
I was driven to Washington every single day.
Well, it's nice to get the ride, but you were convicted of obstruction of justice and sentenced.
I pled guilty.
Right. Which is to say, and this is, I think, what we want to uncover. I think I'm going to take a break right now, and then we're going to come back, and we're also going to talk with two other North Carolina attorneys who played an important role in the Watergate hearings. I want to get your personal take on this and kind of when you decide how you find yourself participating, when you decide it's time to extract and warn the president. All of these things, I think, are matters of process, and we will examine them as our conversation on the state of things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the Watergate hearings, President Nixon announced his intent to resign from the office. He said he was going to do it on the 8th. He did it on the 9th of August in 1974. That resignation, the culmination of events that certainly eroded public faith in government. Nixon's counsel, John Dean, testified at the Watergate hearings about the atmosphere in the Nixon administration. We'll talk more about that. He's with us today. He is the author of a new book called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. And joining me now to engage in that conversation are two men who played key roles in the Watergate investigation. Rufus Edmiston is served as deputy chief counsel to the Watergate Committee, also a Raleigh attorney, and he joins us now. Rufus Edmiston, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Gene Boyce is
good to be back with John. He and I have been on panels before. He has this melodious voice, as you can tell.
Very nice. And Gene Boyce is here as well, a Raleigh attorney who served as assistant majority counsel on the Watergate Committee. Hi, Gene.
Good morning.
Good to talk with you. Rufus, you know, we asked this question earlier that Ken Rudin raised about kind of who's the hero and who isn't, and what's John Dean's role in this. What's your thought on that?
Well, there are a number of heroes to me in Watergate, beginning, of course, with Irvin and Baker. And because the two of them decided it would work, it's the only one that's worked since that time. All these others have flubbed up because they've become bickering partnership. Another hero, in my opinion, John, was James McCord, because he said, I've had enough of this, Judge Sirica. And then I'm going to add John Dean in there because all the time, as Gene Boyce will tell you in a moment, they were saying that John Dean was a liar, that he was a crook, that he everything in the world, all the folks at the White House, the Haldemans, the Ehrlichmans, our intelligence showed that they were trying to destroy John Dean's credibility. Well, he came on to the hearings. He went on for days, and they tried to slip him up on one little thing about the name of a Mayflower hotel when it was a Mayflower coffee shop at another hotel. Now, that was some big deal. And the man simply proved, after the tapes were revealed, that Gene had a lot to do with, that everything that John Dean said was true. And when he did that, he was doing that at great risk because he knew that his career was over. So I'm going to name him, as I did on TV the other day, as one of the Watergate heroes.
Well, John Dean, let me ask you about this. In that tape that we played in our last segment, you've got Richard Nixon saying, hey, you know, we're not the mafia. We're not good at this kind of thing. Clearly, he's ready to do it. He's engaged.
That's my voice. That's my voice. I'm trying to convince him why we shouldn't be paying that money, and we don't know what the hell we're doing.
What's his expression at the time?
He counters everything I have to say. He has a very simple answer. I tell him, for example, in that conversation, I say, well, Bud Krogh, one of his aides, has committed perjury. And Nixon's answer is, well, John, perjury is a pretty easy rap to beat. When I raised the $1 million, which I pulled out of thin air, he says, well, that's not difficult to raise. We can get that. And so I knew I was, and I must have had a, I spoke extemporaneously, and I must have offered him a dozen or more reasons, solid reasons, why the cover-up had to end, and I thought he should take responsibility for ending it. At the end of the day, I didn't carry it at all. He didn't authorize me to go out and raise the money because I had pretty well convinced him that I wasn't interested in having any part of it. In fact, one of the interesting also documents I found is he did a diary entry that night of his conversation. He said it was a pretty slow day, excepting for Dean came in and with this cancer on the presidency thing. And his take was that I was over-emotional. Well, I wasn't emotional at all. I was just cold logic. There are sighs of angst in my voice. You can hear them on that recording occasionally because I'm just frustrated. I can't believe that he's not convinced that this is serious business. And, you know, the conversation also later plays a huge role in how it all unravels.
Well, it does, but primarily because we find out about the tapes. And otherwise, it would have been John Dean's word against a sitting president. That might have been a pretty rough contest. And then there was this day, July 16th, 1973, when Alexander Butterfield, a White House aide, was testifying before the Watergate committee and answered this question.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
That was a surprise. And Gene Boyce, you were called in to handle this case, and primarily because, and I'll let you give us the background, Gene Boyce, because there were a lot of lawyers on that Senate Watergate committee and on the staff of the Judiciary Committee, but not a lot with trial experience. Tell us how you became involved in the case.
It was all very much by accident. I went up to help a newly elected congressman who recruited me to help him set up his staff because there had been a suit about the election and his swearing-in was delayed. He didn't know until December the 27th he was even going to be in Congress. And he persuaded me. I'd been his campaign manager. He persuaded me to go with him just for a short time to set up his staff. He said he was going to be too busy, so he needed somebody to set up his staff. And so I went to Washington for that reason, ready to come home as quickly as possible. And then I kept running into Rufus and Senator Irvin.
And were persuaded to stay. And so what happened when you found out there were actually tape recordings available?
Well, it came somewhat as a shock, although John had given the committee the first hint that was a hint to me in a conversation with the committee. He said on an occasion in September, I believe it was, talking with the president privately in the Oval Office, John said, I felt like I was being recorded because the president was just asking me yes and no questions like I was being cross-examined, leading questions that lawyers refer to. And he said, I just felt like I was being recorded. That gave us a little bit of a hint that maybe it was a Radio Shack recorder hidden somewhere that had been turned on to record that particular thing. We had no idea it was expensive as it turned out to be. But that was the first hint. And then the second hint had to do with Nixon's calendar, in which when I subpoenaed his calendar and got it, there was a summary of what the meetings were about going back 18 years. And so that raised a question, how could they summarize that? Because Nixon was not a real note keeper or diary keeper like Reagan and some of the other presidents had been.
Gene Boyce, can I ask?
Go ahead, Ken.
Let me ask you a question. So when Fred Thompson asked that dramatic question to Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of recording devices, you and the staff already knew the answer. That's correct?
We found out on Friday around 6 o'clock when I was dying to get back to Raleigh, and that was Friday the 13th, July the 13th, a memorable date, one day after my birthday, but on a Friday. And they Butterfield was then FAA chairman. He wanted to go to Moscow, but we told him he needed to stay in Washington a day or two longer, and he was put on the stand that Monday. The amazing thing was the Post never revealed it. It never was leaked, thank goodness.
Well, let me point out that Gene is right. It's the only thing I know of that was never leaked, and we kept it a secret. And every time before a witness went on, as John will tell you, there was extensive interviews with somebody in private, sort of like if you're a good lawyer, you better know what your witness is going to say before you put him on the stand. And I remember, I hate to say this on the radio, but when Gene sent somebody to reveal it to me, I told the senator, and he said, "Don't tell that damn Lowell Weicker." I will never forget that as long as I live. And as Gene will tell you, the decision was made for Fred Thompson to ask the question so it would not seem as though we on the Democratic side, i.e. Senator Ervin and the other committee members, were, quote, out to get the president. So that's the reason you hear Fred Thompson asking the question.
There's also another reason that Don Sanders had actually asked the question of Butterfield. He and Scott Armstrong had interviewed Alex Butterfield on Friday the 13th. And it was during that, and Sanders popped the question, and his motive was they were looking for anything in my testimony that might be askew. And it had only been at the last minute I'd put in my testimony. It had actually been drafted, completed, and I said, you know, I think I was recorded, and this is a real bootstrap thing. I didn't speculate about many things, but I thought, you know, if I put in there that I think there are tapes of one or more of those conversations, no one will think I'm lying about them, which I did. So that was kind of a bootstrap thing I added. And Sanders is the one that said then to Butterfield, you know, Dean made this statement. Not only did I say there were the leading questions, but I said at one point, Nixon gets up on April 15th, is the conversation that actually this flashed in my mind, because he's asking me leading questions. Then he, at one point, gets out of his chair and goes over to the corner of the office, and there's a potted palm there, believe it or not. And he says to me in a stage whisper, he said, "I was foolish to talk to Chuck Colson about clemency for Hunt, wasn't I?" And I said, "Yes, Mr. President, that was probably an obstruction of justice." And that was the kind of question and answer he didn't want recorded, and it just flashed in my mind, he's recording this. It was actually Howard Baker who grilled me during the cross-examination about that. And then the minority staff, all the staff started looking at these issues. And so the minority had a right to ask that question. I think it was good politics by Sam Ervin and the Democrats to let the Republicans raise this highly damaging issue. And the White House was tipped, incidentally. They learn about it. Nixon is in the hospital with pneumonia at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and so he has to decide what to do with it in a pretty weakened condition.
Well, Rufus Edmiston, you talked a little bit about that—the fact that this had been pretty closely arranged, and there was a lot of bipartisan agreement between Howard Baker and Sam Ervin. To talk a little bit about the sort of the backstage arrangements that had been made to stage these hearings.
As John would know, being around Washington, especially Gene, there are two things that are important in Washington, like everywhere else: your parking space and your committee space. So, sounds crazy, but when Watergate came along, I'd been there for 10 years with Senator Ervin as the chief counsel of the Separation of Powers Subcommittee, and we'd studied all these subjects that came up during Watergate, executive privilege, and John, you sometimes had given some opinions way before Watergate on executive privilege that I've chuckled about ever since. But we had to find a way, first of all, to decide how you're going to do something this mammoth, because everybody wanted it on the committee. One reason that Ervin was chosen and the other people that were chosen, none of them wanted to run for president, as you recall, John.
Right.
And he tried to make a committee that would have been out to not run for president, but seek the truth. And, of course, Ervin was in the mind of everybody. I don't think anybody ever objected to that because they knew he would be judicious about it. Well, picking a staff was extremely difficult. Gene, you know what we went through. And I know this, that Senator Ervin and I both said, "Gene, you got to stay." We had to have people up there that knew Senator Ervin. Senator Ervin was a trusting man, believe it or not. He, as fierce an interrogator as he was a trusting man, and I was afraid that some of this stuff would go awry, and we got all these people he didn't know in there. So we put a little closely knit group of North Carolinians around Senator Ervin. We picked the staff, and then we set out, for the first time, as Gene will tell you, a committee of the Congress had a computer system. Gene, you're the one responsible for that.
Yeah, Gene, tell us more about that. Well, I want to interrupt your story for a second to ask Gene about that, because you've got suddenly this bombshell. We've got years of tape recordings But oh no, what do we do with that? What did you do when you found out you had all of this data suddenly available?
Don Sanders was an excellent attorney, a former FBI agent. We really worked closely together. Don and I had discussed ahead of time the possibility of a tape recording system because of some of the prior work and evidence that we had obtained. Time magazine reported it as a throwaway question. It was not. Scott Armstrong asked questions for 3 hours and 15 minutes and never touched on tape recordings. Don very quickly got to the subject that he and I had discussed. He went second, and his comment was, Mr. Butterfield, is there anything to what we've been hearing about a tape recording in the Oval Office? That was the only question. It was not a throwaway question. Mm-hmm. It had been planned in advance between Don and me. Butterfield opened up, and we had to ask very few additional questions. He told the whole story right off. He said he had met with Fred Buzhardt, the then counsel to the president, and that he had to tell the truth. He was under oath. We agreed that we needed the truth, and he came clean very quickly with just that one comment about whether or not a tape system existed in the Oval Office.
Seems to me, though, that what is an attorney's, a prosecutor's dream come true is instantly their nightmare when you realize you've got to somehow handle all of that information. What did you do when you realized there was all this tape? You got to get it, you got to listen to it, you got to document it, and you got to figure out which part of it's evidence. Gene, how did you go about doing that?
Well, it's a known fact among, especially among trial attorneys, that the best evidence begins with what somebody said. That's he said, she said evidence. The next best thing is when the evidence is in writing, in handwriting. The next best evidence is a recording where somebody can hear exactly what was said, the pauses, the hesitations, but the exact words. But the very best nowadays is a videotape where you can not only hear exactly what was said, you can see the people saying it and can see the reactions of those listening. We didn't have the very best evidence, but we had evidence beyond he said, she said, as far as Mr. Butterfield was concerned, because we finally had access, potentially, thanks to Rufus and the subpoena, to those tapes of exactly what was said in a voice recording. And at that time, that was the best evidence of what the truth is.
Well, Frank, I got to point out, though, before the discovery of the tapes, Gene had devised a system, though, of computerizing very primitively all the proceedings of the committee so that we could index witnesses, that thing, well before the tapes. So
I was going to say that's true. I had friends over in the Library of Congress having lunch one day, and they said they were putting the card catalog on a computer, and I asked them what was a computer. This was 1973. They took me over to the library and showed me the computer, walked down the hall, opened the door, and there was a bunch of black boxes just blinking lights. And I said, this is a computer. And they said, yeah, we're putting the card catalogs into the computer. We have 70 million books, and we need quicker access to them. And I asked them what they did with that computer after hours, and they said nothing from midnight to 8 in the morning. And I got an agreement that the Watergate Committee could use the computer to put in all of our the investigation was tremendous, done on 3x5 index cards coming in hundreds a day. Unbelievable.
Gene Boyce and John Dean, I know you've been asked this question a gazillion times, and 40 years later, we're still thinking about this question, but why do you think President Nixon didn't destroy the tapes, given that this was the evidence that could do him in?
Yeah, it actually comes up in a couple of recorded conversations in April of 1973, where Nixon decides he does want to remove the system. And he asks Haldeman, and Haldeman says, sure, I'll take care of it. Haldeman, because he then gets himself consumed in Watergate, never comes around to doing it. Nixon raises it again. He wants to at least get rid of everything excepting some of the national security material because he's worried that Henry Kissinger might write a history differently than he remembered it in the Oval Office. So Nixon wants to keep that. But he does, in fact, he takes the system out in April in Camp David. He leaves the telephones in. But even Al Haig at that late date, after Haldeman and Ehrlichman and everybody's gone, does not know the taping system exists in the form it exists. He knows that there are recordings of me, but he thinks Nixon has done that with a control switch, not that it's voice activated as it was. And listening to hundreds of hours of these things, I must say that the person that seems most aware of the system is Haldeman, but he forgets at times. And Nixon really is not, only seldom was he conscious when he was trying to make a record. One of the interesting things is when Howard Baker had his backdoor visit with Nixon early on after being selected as vice chair of the Senate Watergate Committee, he wants to slip in and have a secret meeting. Well, about 18 minutes of the meeting is recorded. It's not a very good recording. I listened to it. You can get the gist of it. Nixon wants to know who this guy Fred Thompson is. And they actually then drift into a corridor between the president's office and the reception area and talk there, and none of that does get picked up. He then turns around and reports to Haldeman and Ehrlichman exactly what had been discussed, so there was a pretty good record. That meeting with Baker is still not on Nixon's official calendar.
Well, speaking of 18 minutes, oh no, we're going to take a break right now. Then we'll come back and speak of 18 and a half minutes and much, much more as our conversation with John Dean, Ken Rudin, and Rufus Edmiston and Gene Boyce continues on the state of things as we look at the resignation of Richard Nixon 40 years later. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the Watergate scandal. August 9th marks the 40th year since President Nixon resigned. Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us, as is Rufus Edmiston, who served as the deputy counsel to Senator Sam Ervin, who is chairman of what was called the Senate Watergate Committee. And Gene Boyce served as assistant majority counsel on that same committee. John Dean is here. He's author of the new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean, we were talking about, you know, sort of why Nixon didn't get rid of those tapes. He knew he had it. There's a clip here of one of those tapes, a conversation between Charles Colson and Richard Nixon. It was recorded in 1973. And here's Colson essentially warning the president of the same thing you did, saying, I'm a little bit concerned about this. The opening line here, Nixon is saying, Dean is doing a great job, or Dean is doing a spectacular work. It's hard to hear that part. But I want you to hear how guarded they both are.
Keeping all the fires out. He's concerned about, you know, what bubbles out, you know.
Yeah, well, Dean is a problem also, Mr. President. I didn't want to say this to you Monday night when you mentioned to me that Dean has done a spectacular job. I don't think anybody could do as good a job as John has done. The problem I foresee in this is not what has happened so far. I mean, I think the mystery of the Watergate... I don't know whether somebody else higher up in the committee for the re-election is going to get named or not. But to me, that is a very great consequence to the country if it happens. The thing that worries me is the possibility of somebody charging an obstruction of justice problem. In other words, the subsequent actions would worry me more than anything. And that's where John has... And he's done all the things that have to be done, but that makes him a little more of a participant than he would like if he's the fellow that has to coordinate it all.
So that's a telephone call, right, in mid-April. Colson's totally unaware of my March 21 conversation with Nixon, and he's left the White House at this point. He's also talking to his partner, a fellow by the name of Dave Shapiro, who was a criminal defense lawyer. And Chuck has slowly but steadily told his partner his own problems, and his partner realizes that Chuck has got a nightmare on his hands, and one is obstruction of justice.
What's Richard Nixon, how confident is he that his closest allies in the White House, the people who had been supporting him, are going to stay with him?
He's not confident at all. In fact, from literally March 21 on, and particularly after the letter from Jim McCord surfaces, that's when he really goes into a protracted period of dread and concern. And it manifests itself in an interesting way. He becomes obsessive-compulsive about it. He repeats himself, and we're not talking once or twice. We're talking conversation after conversation ad nauseum. And each one, he will add a little different twist or a little different spin somewhere along the line. You couldn't bore a reader with all this repetition, so I had to kind of distill all those down and find out what was different from conversation to conversation. But he is very worried. He's worried particularly about the conversation he had with me where he said it was no problem to raise $1 million. He hadn't forgotten that.
Ken?
I'm just going to say I'm sorry. What fascinates me about this whole thing is that these conversations that the president's having with John Dean and others, this happens 5 months or less after the president wins a 49-state landslide. I'd love to know what John Dean saw in the change of Richard Nixon going from November 1972 when he won everything but Massachusetts. And
he ranks third to this day in landslides. Anyway, what he is he's depressed. He has won. He has the prize, and it's empty. It's empty, and he cannot figure out, and he writes in his own memoirs, he's not quite sure, but he suspects it was Watergate looming that was causing him to not be all excited. The air went out of the balloon at that time because he really didn't work on trying to get conservatives or Republicans elected. And while he didn't think he could win the Congress, he thought he could win sort of ideological or philosophical, a broader control. And so everyone knew that Watergate wasn't going to go away after the election. The other thing is, as he is settling the Vietnam problem, he's really taking away his last bit of leverage where the Congress is with him. And when he gets a peace settlement in January, he loses all congressional support at that point.
But it does seem to me, John, that you pointed to some of this. While Watergate may have brought on kind of acute symptoms of this, I think you pointed to some of this in your very opening testimony, which preceded Watergate, some of the atmosphere around the White House. Let's listen to your opening testimony.
To one who was in the White House and became somewhat familiar with its inner workings, the Watergate matter was an inevitable outgrowth of a climate of excessive concern over the political impact of demonstrators, excessive concern over leaks, an insatiable appetite for political intelligence, all coupled with a do-it-yourself White House staff, regardless of the law.
So this had been brewing for quite a while.
Oh, indeed. And listening to that statement, you know, I was horrified when they told me I had to read it. It was 60,000 words. If they'd have told me I was going to read a statement, it would have been 6,000. And so I was flabbergasted, and I wasn't sure I could read for a whole day.
And it was broadcast live.
It was broadcast live.
Well, as John said, I may interrupt here. If you look at the story of Sam Ervin and Richard Nixon from almost day one, Senator Ervin was very skeptical of Nixon, and he would tell me that because I drove him for 10 years. He said, I just don't understand that man. He said he's afraid of freedom. And if you go back and you look at the Constitutional Rights Subcommittee where I was, and then later I was the chief counsel of the Separation of Powers Subcommittee, we studied all these things that John mentioned that came up, the surveillance by civilians of the military and this and that. And there was a gradual buildup, and John was right. Ervin and Richard Nixon just didn't really like one another, and they didn't trust one another. And finally, Ervin sort of gets his day with Watergate, and I'm not saying there was a vendetta. He just didn't trust the man, John.
No,
and
I
by
know.
The way, may I ask this? At what point did Richard Nixon have come out and said, look, I fouled up, I'm sorry, I want the American people to forgive me, my staff screwed up, I screwed up. At what point could he have done that, John? I've been asked that a million times. Of course,
that's
I have
what
no
Reagan
idea.
Did. That's what Reagan did with Iran-Contra.
Correct.
June 20, 1972, right after the break-in is when he should have done it. And he knows the problem. There's one point where he literally, in talking to Colson and learns that McCord is involved, throws an ashtray across the room in Florida. He's so angered. He then starts walking back that and says, well, I can't have that kind of attitude. I've got to just take this as something that's no big deal, and he does. But he has a very small window. He just marches right into a conspiracy to obstruct justice, not intentionally, not wittingly, but certainly unwittingly. But he does know the difference between perjury and truth. And he also suborns perjury, which is one of the real findings I was surprised to see him so deeply involved in.
Well, part of it was the belief that I guess he was in an untouchable, that he had certain privileges as president that Rufus, you found later he didn't, and demonstrated that, particularly when you served a subpoena.
Well, yes. If you'll note, the committee voted unanimously on that subpoena. The Supreme Court voted unanimously that no president, nobody in government anywhere has the right to say that under some foolish notion of executive privilege, you can cover up a criminal act. And, you know, they keep talking all this stuff today about impeachable stuff on Obama and this and that. You know, there's just no comparison whatsoever. These were allegations of criminal conduct, which you can never shield under any legal theory.
You know what's interesting, though? He did have one with the Congress. The Congress never gets the tapes. It's only the grand jury subpoena that is ruled on by the Supreme Court. Sirica dismisses the case brought by Sam Dash and the Senate Watergate Committee. They never obtain the tapes. They have to get them through the prosecutor.
Yeah, I know.
Well, there was a lot of personal drama in this, too. And so here is also a moment in the hearings, John, where you pretty much make it clear that you have broken with the White House. Let's listen.
On April 17th, 1973, the president said this: I condemn any attempts to cover up in this case, no matter who is involved. Do you believe he was telling the truth on that date?
No, sir.
Now, John, before you say anything, here to me is the most important moment in that entire clip. Let's listen to this. What was going through your mind in that 5 seconds of silence?
Well, you know, it's like kind of like Butterfield's 5 seconds of silence before he could answer whether there was a taping system. And I asked Alex, I said, what the hell are you waiting for? He said, you know, I don't know. It was stupid. I know what the question they were going to ask me, and I was ready to answer it. I wasn't trying to be theatrical. Maybe I was scratching my head. I don't know what accounts for that at this late date.
You understood you did understand the concept. I mean, that's the next question.
Absolutely.
Sam Dash says, do you understand, yeah, you know, the magnitude of what you just said?
The lingering question still is, why did Nixon not destroy the tapes? In January of 1974, when I first got back to Raleigh, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina stopped me on the Federal Street Mall and said, Gene, why has the president not destroyed those tapes?
John?
No, there are two reasons he didn't. One is he never thought he would be forced to turn them over. He got as ironclad a decision or ruling and opinion from his lawyer, Charles Allen Wright, as you can imagine, telling him the Supreme Court couldn't get them. Charles Allen Wright was very good on federal civil and criminal procedures, not so good on his constitutional estimate of what would happen in that political context. But that was one reason. He never thought he'd lose them. Secondly, he realized they had great economic value. That's one of the things he and Haldeman discuss, that these have significant monetary value. He had used his vice presidential papers to get an overly exaggerated tax shelter that got cut off. But he thought there was value in these, and there wouldn't indeed be. When he finally, after the Congress takes them, he goes to court, and under eminent domain law, he got compensation. He got several million dollars.
I'm just thinking of how D's and R's don't talk to each other anymore, and I'm thinking, Rufus, the relationship between Sam Ervin and Howard Baker, who recently passed away, must have been just fascinating to watch, given the fact that I think Baker was thrown on the committee as punishment because there were some in the Republican Party who just wanted to pay him back for challenging the leadership. But the relationship between Ervin and Baker always fascinated me.
Well, I just finished a oral history with the U.S. Senate office with Catherine Harper. And in there, I discussed how things were back 40 years ago and how they are now. And I recently had a conversation with my friend Joe Manchin, with whom I served when I was Secretary of State in North Carolina. He was Secretary of State in West Virginia. And we discussed the very things that he mentioned in Time magazine a week ago. They don't know one another now. They don't talk to one another. They don't have social events. They come in on Tuesday. They leave on Thursday. They don't have any kind of camaraderie. And the staff used to have these huge staff parties up there. Remember, Gene, we would have staff parties, and you'd have 300 or 400 staff people. We would take buses and go up to the gambling, the horse races, and this and that.
Well, the problem, Rufus, is many of those ended up in the fountain somewhere in Washington, D.C., and that's
I think there were a lot of parties.
That's what
in
ended
the
those, I think. Right? Yeah. but forgive me, I interrupted.
But anyway, it is a different atmosphere because of, in my opinion, these crazies on both sides on these talk shows stirring up people. And there are a lot of people of goodwill still in the Congress, but they're not allowed to do it because these idiots on television and radio, and because of that most horrible decision, John. Now, Citizens United has put us again where we are headed for another Watergate. This is one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court's ever handed down.
You and Richard Nixon are going to find yourself in agreement on that. He talks about that at some length. The impact of money and what it's doing to his campaign and why it caused Watergate.
Most of the stupid stuff they did, like the dirty tricks and all that, was because they had all these pots of money and they didn't know what to do with them.
Well, John, let me ask you to comment on those two things. Number one, the kind of polarization that has occurred in the decades since, but also a kind of larger picture about whether or not we were shocked and the nation was pretty much unified by the time it was all over about the fact that president must go. And I wonder if we're just as shocked today or if we've been somehow anesthetized to this kind of a scandal and if we've become less sensitive to these kinds of outrages against the public trust. So I'll ask you to comment on both of those, John Dean.
First, as you might know, Nixon had a Southern strategy, and part of that strategy was to develop what they called wedge issues back in those days to try to drive people apart. And it worked, and it was used by later politicians very effectively and is part of the reason we have the polarization we have today. There's no question at the time Nixon does leave office that 79 was the lowest poll I saw from Gallup, showing that 79% of the American people supported his decision to resign and thought that was the right thing to do. It's pretty hard to get 80% of Americans to agree on anything. He was a divider and a unifier in some regards.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I'm thinking of the NSA scandal and some of the deception that led us into war, all of these things that should have violated the public trust that seem not to bother us anymore. Do you think we've become anesthetized to this kind of scandal?
Well, at the time the Patriot Act was adopted in the aftermath of 9/11, people were uncertain and they were looking for any remedy, and so some of the worst things that were sitting around in desk drawers here in Washington were pulled out and put into law. I guess it fits in as well with the new generations who seem to not care much about their privacy. The Internet has changed that significantly, and so people just assume, well, I may be giving up some freedom for these free apps, but I don't really mind. This is a dangerous way to think because you can't recover these freedoms once they're gone.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. John Dean was legal counsel to President Nixon. His new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, is going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh next Tuesday, August 5th. And you can get more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Rufus Edmiston served as deputy chief counsel to the Watergate Committee. He's a Raleigh attorney. Rufus Edmiston, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gene Boyce, Raleigh attorney who served as assistant majority counsel on the Watergate Committee. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you in Raleigh, John.
Thank you, John Dean.
I look forward to visiting you all.
And the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Thank you, Ken.
Frank, am I still on your enemies list?
You will never be removed so long as I remain in office. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Intern Charlie Shelton, Robin Copley is our technical director. Brett Wolf is the news director. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.